This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, with lots of help from reporters Dennis Hart, Cal Halliburton, and Pat Schlarbaum. My featured guest will be Jane Ajiman, director of TRIO and Upward Bound at Iowa State. You'll hear about that later in the program. But here's Dennis with a distillation of the regional weekly newspapers. Regular listeners of Local Talk will recognize that there is news at the beginning of Local Talk programs on Monday and Friday. The Friday news from the Ames Tribune formerly included a short segment drawn from the weekly papers. Since we cover the listening area around Ames and frequently get stories from the Nevada Journal, Tri-County Times, Boone News Republican, and Story City Herald, we welcomed having this news on Local Talk Wednesday. So here's Dennis.
The Nevada Journal reported on a recent city council meeting where the council approved an $8,700 screen for the City Hall campus area. The screen will block the sun when performers are facing west. The council also decided to let the Story County Medical Center leave the windmill that it owns on city property just north of U.S. Highway 30. The council had previously set a deadline for that windmill to be moved, but knowing the hospital has a buyer, the city has agreed to give that buyer until year's end to move it. The council also heard about the city's plans for the Register's annual Great Bike Ride across Iowa. Lincoln Highway through the Nevada city limits will be closed from 6 a.m. to noon on Wednesday, July 25th. Also in the journal, a report on the recent Nevada school board meeting, which began with a salute to Kids at First volunteers. About 20 students and 10 community members were present when Superintendent Steve Gray handed the volunteers their certificates of appreciation. Later, board members heard from drama participants in this year's spring play, Seussical the Musical. The journal also had word that Dennis Otto has been chosen as honorary parade marshal for this year's Memorial Day observance in Nevada. He served in Vietnam, was wounded, and received two Purple Hearts in recognition of his service to the Army. The journal also reported that Colo Nesco students, from fifth graders to seniors, recently got to go to a movie in Marshalltown. But that was not time away from learning. The movie was called Wonder, and teachers thought it was a good one for middle and high school students to see and learn more about the acceptance of others. In the recent Boone News Republican, word that the Boone School Board approved the addition of panic buttons for each school in the district. When those buttons are pressed, they will notify Boone police. The board also approved purchasing a new system that schools can use in their front offices, one that scans visitors' driver's licenses, does a quick background check, and then prints badges for visitors to wear inside schools. Also in the News Republican, a word that seven members of the Boone FFA chapter volunteer group recently worked at the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad to get the railroad ready for the summer season. Among other things, they put mulch on the south side of the railroad's museum, cleaned an activities car, and weeded flower beds. In the Story City Herald, word that the Roland Story School Board recently heard that the district's financial health is good. Superintendent Matt Patton told school board members that taking into account a variety of analytic indicators, the district should be in good financial shape for, in his words, many years to come. Also in the Herald, word that Roland Story agriculture education students and FFA members from the ag business class recently spent time with cleanup efforts at the Winfield Plant Prairie area in Story City. And that is your summary of news from recent issues of the weekly Nevada Journal, Boone News Republican, and Story City Herald. I'm KHOI Civic Reporter Dennis Hart. I'll be back Friday with a look at the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
Thank you, Dennis. It's time to turn to the final interview from Candidates with Cal, the 8th gubernatorial candidate, Fred Hubble. In the past 2.5 weeks, we have brought you interviews with all primary candidates for governor, 6 Democrats and 2 Libertarians. We haven't heard from Governor Kim Reynolds because she's running unopposed and has no primary opponent. But there is a lot to think about in the words of each of the primary candidates. So let's hear what Fred Hubble has to say.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Mr. Fred Hubble. Mr. Hubble is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Mr. Hubble has deep Iowa roots. The Hubble family settled in Iowa in the middle 1800s and founded some of early Iowa's most successful businesses. Fred met his wife Charlotte in law school at the University of Iowa. He went on to lead some of Iowa's largest businesses, employing thousands of Iowans. He served as chairman of Yonkers, president of Equitable of Iowa Life Insurance Company, several executive positions with the ING Group, and lead director of Voya Financial. He served as interim director of the Iowa Department of Economic Development when he was asked to clean up the film tax credit scandal. Fred Hubble has a history of public service in Iowa. He's been a longtime supporter and volunteer with organizations such as United Way, Planned Parenthood, Urban Dreams, Simpson College, Broadlawns Medical Center, Iowa Environmental Council, and Iowa's Water and Land Legacy. Fred and Charlotte have three children and three grandchildren. Mr. Hubble, please tell our listeners something about yourself they'll not find on your website or with a search engine.
Thank you for the very thorough introduction. I appreciate that. You know, one of the things I like to do is participate in RAGBRAI. I've been on six or seven different RAGBRAIs in different parts of the state because it's a great way to see Iowa. You really get to see the variations in our topography and the different people and the communities. And I enjoy the exercise, but I enjoy the camaraderie of the journey that you're on in RAGBRAIs. It's a lot of fun.
Well, in your travels around the state, you have had a lot of contact with people. What are their big concerns now?
Well, we've been traveling to all 99 counties, meeting with people and their businesses and their farms and their homes and their coffee shops. And the things that we hear the most all across Iowa, the first one is mental health and substance abuse. Virtually every place we go, we're talking about mental health and substance abuse. It's everywhere in our state, and it just keeps expanding. So that comes up a lot because people are afraid of it, and they're afraid that we're not dealing with it in our state, and it's just hurting their families, and it's hurting them as individuals. Privatization of Medicaid is also a topic that comes up a lot because that's affecting, you know, 600,000 Iowans are in Medicaid, but they all have family members. That really impacts probably half our population, and that's a failure all across Iowa. Over 40,000 people have benefits denied or reduced. Healthcare providers have been forced out of business. And education is the other one that comes up. People know their class sizes are getting bigger in rural Iowa. Some schools don't have bands anymore. Some schools don't have the same instruments that they used to have, or art classes are being cut. Some kids are spending way too much time on the buses. You know, unfortunately, the quality of our education, particularly in rural Iowa, is really getting hurt, and so is healthcare. So we hear that everywhere we go.
Are there some very specific things you see yourself doing as governor to deal with those?
Yeah, there really are. Privatization of Medicaid, that decision, that implementation was done without any involvement from the legislature. So on day one as governor, I'm going to start bringing that back into state control, state management, state direction. So we have Iowans making decisions about fellow Iowans rather than out-of-state companies that are being paid to make a profit and pad their own bank accounts, if you will. So I want to start that right away. But the other thing we need to do is we have serious fiscal mismanagement in our state. I mean, I've worked in the private sector, as you said, in the public sector, and everywhere I've been, I've always tried to take a fiscally responsible, long-term approach. You know, when you're running a business or you're running the Department of State Government, that's what one should do. But unfortunately, this governor and this legislature are taking all across the board a very short-term approach. You know, they continue every year to fund what I call wasteful corporate giveaways, mostly corporate, some individual. And I've identified those when I was on a tax credit review panel in 2009 and 2010. We looked at every single credit, exemption, deduction. These are annual exemptions and credits that taxpayers get on their tax return every year. The reason I say wasteful is because the ones that we identified may cost the state, for example, a dollar, but the benefit back to the state is less than a dollar. So why should we continue to do those? And there's quite a few of those in our state, and they add up to millions and millions of dollars. And they don't have caps on them, so they've actually gotten bigger over time. What I want to do right away is start putting in place a fiscally responsible approach to managing the taxpayers' dollars. We should require caps on all the credits, exemptions, and deductions so they don't grow without legislative involvement. We should have sunset provisions that require the governor or the legislature to actually look at them periodically to see if they're still a priority. And where we're not getting adequate value as citizens or taxpayers from those credits, we should either reduce them or eliminate them. So I want to take that $160 million, because that's the value of what we identified, and put that money instead into long-term investments in education and healthcare and infrastructure across our state. Because if we just take that money that the state is already collecting, and instead of giving it out annually to businesses for short-term benefits, let's give it to them in a long-term benefit with education and healthcare, that's going going to give them the employees they need in the future. We're not taking money out of people's pockets. We're just giving it to them over time to support the long-term growth of their families or their businesses rather than short-term tax cuts.
If you're elected then, I assume your top priorities would be to deal with those things you've focused on.
Yes, sir.
Is there anything else that you would seek to deal with besides those things that seem to be on people's minds all the time?
Well, once you start privatization of Medicaid and get rid of that, so you put that back on a more stable, fair process, management for patients, the participants in Medicaid, and you attack the budget and free up those giveaways, the long-term health of our state really depends upon investing in people. When we invest in education and we aspire to be number one in education again, we used to be recognized all across the country as one of the best in education. We're not there now. Iowans know it and other states know it. So it's harder to recruit jobs to our and people to move to our state than it used to be. So if we invest in education and aspire to be the best, that's going to take a while, but we can get there if we just commit to wanting to do that. Same thing in healthcare. Rather than being known now as the state that has the most extreme anti-women's healthcare law in the country, let's be known for having some of the best healthcare, including mental health care, in our country. If we do that, people will want to come to our state, you know, because they can't find that in too many states. So let's attract people based upon those things rather than just a lot of tax credits.
Well, speaking of attracting people to this state, I'm an immigrant. My parents came here looking for work. And yet some of the policies that I see now are very discouraging to immigration of any kind, whether it's from outside the country or outside the state.
You're right.
How would you deal with that?
Put it this way. I would have vetoed the Sanctuary Cities Bill because all that does is send the wrong message. We're not a welcoming community. We're not a welcoming state. We're not being inclusive. And Bob Rae, 1974, I think, started the idea that, look, we need more people in our state and we need to be welcoming and we should encourage not just immigrants, but people in general to move to Iowa and help us grow our state. And Tom Vilsack took the same approach. Ever since Governor Branstad came back in 2010 and now Governor Reynolds, they're just going the opposite direction. They talk about we need more people and all the businesses say we need more people, but the legislature and the governor are going the opposite direction. They're discouraging people with Sanctuary Cities Bill. They had a bill in there for a while for religious discrimination. That would have do the same thing. This anti-women's health care bill sends the wrong message. We're not going to attract the jobs of the future and doctors to come to our state when we have that kind of legislation. We don't want to be known as extreme. We want to be known as welcoming.
One of the things that might help attract people to the state, especially for initial employment, may have something to do with minimum wage. While the legislature has said, no, you can't establish a local minimum wage any bigger than the statewide, some folks are calling for the minimum wage to increase to $15 an hour. So do you have a position on that?
Sure. First of all, I think we need to raise the minimum wage, but I want to do it at the state level and then let local communities go higher. So if Ames wants to go to 15 or 18 or whatever they want to go to, that should be a local decision. The state needs to get it higher and the community should be able to go higher if they want to. But my focus is minimum wage is important. We need to raise that. But I want to keep the focus on incomes. We need to raise our incomes in our state. If you look at what's happened in the last 4 years in Iowa, we've been between 47th and 49th each of the last 4 years in personal income growth. Not only are we a low-income state, low-wage state, but we have no growth compared to all the other states in the country. So let's focus on getting incomes up for everybody in Iowa. That's why education is important. That's why health care, infrastructure like roads and bridges, but also high-speed internet all across our state. You know, I'm traveling all over Iowa now, and I run into a lot of places and a lot of towns where we don't have high-speed internet. I talked to a woman in Storm Lake the other day. She's finishing school. She's got a job in San Francisco. I asked her, do you have high-speed internet in your community in Storm Lake? She says, not really. It's pretty spotty. Could you do your job today in Storm Lake instead of in California? No. If you had high-speed internet, I said, if you had that in your community, could you work in Iowa rather than in San Francisco? She said, yes. That's the point. We need to give people the tools to stay in Iowa and go to work where they live rather than forcing them to go someplace else.
Don't we have an infrastructure that would support that?
That certainly could be part of the equation. You know, we have cables underground to a lot of parts of our state, and there are some technology out there where you could actually take that and then with satellite connections be able to expand it. Farmers are going to need the same thing. Agriculture is increasingly becoming very technologically driven, right on the equipment, and they're going to need to have that out in their fields, not just in their houses. This affects everybody in our state, and it's the future of our state. We need to make those investments. We're not making them today. Could I share an example?
Please.
In Des Moines, you know, we have Facebook, Microsoft, and Apple now building data centers. $120 million in tax credits for those data centers. Why didn't we say, rather than all these warehouses that have machines and a few mechanics, didn't we take that $120 million and instead go to all the telecommunications providers in our state and provide tax credits for them to extend out that very expensive last mile? So we actually would have high-speed internet all across our state, everywhere, every farm, every house, every town. Then we could really do some economic development in our state. That would have been a much better investment, and it would have benefited a lot more people.
One of the things that I found, we've got 8,000 pools of poo right around the state. There's some investment that could be made there. How could you deal with that?
That's a serious issue in our state. Let me just give you one really small little thing. When I'm on Ragbri across the northern part of our state, that's where we have more of the confined animal feeding operations. So you know what? Every once in a while, you go by one, and they've surrounded the CAFO with trees. And so when you're riding your bike by on the roads or you're driving by, you don't hardly smell anything. But then you go by one where they haven't surrounded by trees, and you can smell a lot. There are little things that we could do that could make a difference for people who live in those communities as well as, you know, the passersby. But fundamentally, the issue is that industry has grown so fast that it's kind of outgrown the effectiveness of our master matrix, which is the system that governs where and how new ones can be built. And we have 20 or 30 counties somewhere in there that have actually filed formal protests with the Department of Natural Resources against the matrix. So what I'm suggesting that we need to do is, if I become governor, then on January 1 of 2019, I would appoint a blue ribbon commission with people from the livestock industry, people who represent boards of supervisors and local citizens, and have a blue ribbon commission, give them 90 days to come up with suggested legislation to address the environmental issues, to address the lack of local control, local input, and to fix the loopholes in the master matrix. I don't want to kill the industry, but I want to make sure all those other pieces are represented and properly dealt with, because they're not. And in 90 days, we should have legislation come out, and then we can take it to the legislature and try to move forward, because we need to bring the industry and everybody else back into more proper balance there.
There's another issue that floats around the state, and our state legislature has taken an interesting approach to it, and that's guns. What do we do about that?
Our governor was asked that same question, and she said we have reasonable gun laws in Iowa, and it's really a federal issue, so there's nothing to talk about. And I think, frankly, she's wrong on both counts, because we have a lot of people who don't think our gun laws are reasonable in Iowa, and that's why you have a lot of people raising issues. And also, we've had a lot of laws last year in the legislature that addressed various gun issues that were passed, and there were some this year, too. So it's clearly not just a federal issue. And we need to focus on public safety and gun safety. It's not just an issue of gun rights versus gun control. We need to focus on gun safety and public safety and really focus in on what Iowans want to do about those issues, because we're out of balance in that area, just like we were on the confined animal feeding operations.
I've got a whole list of these. One is illegal drugs, but also more than that is the overuse of prescription drugs. What kinds of things could the governor do?
The governor just signed a new law that the legislature passed to help address opiate addiction and the spread of opiates. The issue for me, however, you know, because I've traveled all across the state, we had 10 different meetings in county jails with county sheriffs, county attorneys, people that work in the mental health substance abuse area. I've visited many hospitals and talked to the people that handle those issues in their emergency rooms. And what you actually find is about half the people in the county jails or in the prisons or in emergency rooms have some kind of combined substance abuse and mental health issue, more often that way than separate. And at the same time, what you hear is that in different parts of Iowa, substance abuse is different substances. In some areas, opiates are the most popular. Other areas, it's marijuana. Other areas, it's heroin. Other areas, it's alcohol. And in fact, what happens typically is if you make one substance more difficult, then the people will find another substance that's easily accessible and less expensive. So we need to address the whole substance abuse issue and the whole mental health issue. That's why we put out a plan in early December based upon all those meetings we had around the state, listening to people all that work in this area. And our plan addresses the shortage of doctors, the shortage of long-term beds, short-term beds, jail diversion programs, crisis intervention programs. We don't even have a youth-based mental health program in our state. We need to have one of those. We don't need to study it again. It's already been studied many times. There's already good proposals out there. We just need to start implementing them. And when I talk mental health, it's mental health and substance abuse combined.
What else would you like to say?
Well, I guess I would just close by saying everywhere I've gone, what I've learned is if you put people first and you give people the support and the training and the tools that they need to be successful, then whatever organization, whatever group you're involved with, you'll be much more successful.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Mr. Fred Hubble. Mr. Hubble is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Cal. I appreciate the chance to be here.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Fred Hubbell, candidate for governor of Iowa. Fred's interview with Cal Halliburton was the final installment of the gubernatorial candidates appearing with candidates on Candidates with Cal. To hear a compilation of the interviews, listen tomorrow, Thursday, May 24th, to Heart of Iowa at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. We're shifting gears now to learn about a very interesting program that will be taking place on the ISU campus this summer. Jane Ajiman, director of TRIO and Upward Bound, came to the studio yesterday to tell us about a great tradition at Iowa State.
I am Jane O. Ajiman from Iowa State University's TRIO Upward Bound program.
What is Upward Bound?
Upward Bound is a federally funded program that was started in 1965 by the Johnson administration, and it's a program that is intended to identify low-income students whose parents do not have a four-year college degree and help them to navigate the waters so they can someday be the first generation to attend college.
Well, I would think there would be millions of students that would fit that definition. So how do you select your students for Upward Bound?
Yeah, you're correct. We can't have enough funding to serve everybody that is going to be eligible by that criteria. And so we do the best we can and serve the neediest of the needy. So we go to the schools that we identify, recruit from there, tell them about the services that we provide. A student has to be about 95% of our students qualified by both criteria. And then the remaining 5% are usually ones that are referred to us by counselors, a school counselor. A majority of our students are identified through that process of calculating their family income through a federal equation that we're given, and then combining that with their eligibility as a potential first generation because their parents don't have a four-year college degree.
Well, how does this differ from the College of Admissions?
Well, it's different in the sense that when admission counselors go out to the schools to talk to the students, they are there to talk to them about coming to Iowa State. The Upward Bound program, on the other hand, when we're out there talking to the students, we're trying to talk them into going to college, period. And it doesn't matter what college they are looking at going to. Our job is to help them identify, first of all, what it is that they hope to study when they go to college. And as a result of that decision, help them to identify which college, regardless of which state it's in, that will help them attain the ultimate goal.
Is there any diversity component to this selection process?
No, because poor is poor, and we have low-income households across all ethnicities, and that's the beauty of the Upward Bound program, or the TRIO programs in general, is that we do not have an ethnic criteria that a person has to belong to. And so here in the state of Iowa, our population that we serve typically reflects the population of Iowa, being predominantly Caucasian. However, for some reason that I still can't explain, the Upward Bound program at Iowa State University has been, for the last 5 or 6 years, heavily Latino because we're serving Marshalltown, Fort Dodge, and Perry. And I think it's the influx of Latino into Perry and Marshalltown. And so our population right now, we sit about, oh, I would say very easily 75% of our students in Upward Bound are Latino students.
How do they find out about this? Because it seems like it's sort of generic, go to college. And obviously, as I said, the millions of students into your guidelines. Do school counselors identify students that seem to have special gifts that would benefit from a college education?
Yeah, each school is different in terms of recruiting from the schools. But mainly, usually, we inform the counselors that we're going to be in their school on a particular day. And in liaison with the counselors, sometimes a school will select specific free and reduced lunch eligible students who have a reasonably good GPA that they know that this person is, and they know the families, and so they know what our criteria is, and so they kind of handpick some of those students to come and listen to our spiel, so to speak. In other schools, they give us the audience of the entire ninth grade. And so they have an assembly of ninth graders, and we go talk to the entire ninth grade in the auditorium and tell them about the services that the program offers. And those who get excited pick up an application, take it home, get it filled out, and return it, and then we check their eligibility. So it's a variety of ways that we recruit, but each has the tendency to yield a slightly different number. The one that yields the most number of students certainly will be the ones who have been selected, so to speak, by the counselors because they know already that they're going to meet the income guidelines. And number two, knowing that they know the families, they also know that these are potentially going to be first generation eligible also.
You mentioned they get excited about what the program provides. What does the program provide?
Okay. The program provides to committed students an opportunity to come to Iowa State on Saturday morning, when they could very well be sleeping in. Saturday morning, for example, Fort Dodge High School will have to pick them up at 7:30 in the morning on a Saturday, and we bring them to the Iowa State campus. While they're there, we provide them with 2 hours of tutoring on Saturday in math and science. And then after the two-hour tutoring service, we feed them lunch, and then we take them home. The one thing that usually catches their ear is that federal government allows us, because of the dedication of these students and the commitment that they make, because other students could be working on a Saturday morning and making a little bit of money. So we are allowed by federal government to give them up to about $40 a month per student in what we call stipends during the academic year. So those Saturday tutoring sessions are typically held during the school year when they are in school, and it's intended to help them do better on their tests and intended to help them work on their homework. And we also have a computer lab on campus that they can do their research on if they are working on a paper or something for school. They can bring their projects also. But it's a place for them to come and do schoolwork. And then occasionally, about every quarter, we have an additional Saturday meeting where we have workshops where we talk about like study skills, time management, all kinds of workshops that we, interpersonal communication. And sometimes we have invited guests to come and talk to them about careers, different careers that are out there that are not your mainstream careers that students are familiar with. So that is the academic year component. But the part that excites most freshmen when we go to talk to them is a summer component where we bring them to come and live on campus, on the ISU campus, in air-conditioned rooms where they are sharing a room with their best buddy, and because we allow them to pick their own roommates. But for 4 weeks, they stay on campus, and we hire high school teachers to teach them whatever math class they're going to be taking next year when they go to fall. So this is intended, the summer program is intended to give them a head start on next year's classes. So each student that comes to us in the summer takes the math class that they're going to take in the fall, the science class that they're going to take in the fall. Each student takes a literature class, and each student takes a composition class. And then we have elective classes, which differ from year to year. Sometimes it's American Sign Language, sometimes it's theater, sometimes it's sociology, sometimes modern Europe. And so the concept of leaving home and being treated like an adult, living on a college campus, is what excites the new students a lot. While they're there, they take their classes very seriously because the classes are graded just like they have it in school. And the reason why we grade it and the students take it seriously is because at the end of the 4 week period, we have a banquet and we have an award ceremony where their parents and their families, grandmas and all of that come to the banquet. And if they worked very hard, they get an award certificate. In addition to that, if any student that passes with a B or better average grade gets to go on an end-of-year summer trip. This year, for example, we're taking them to Yellowstone. Last year, some of them, for the first time, flew on an airplane, for example. And it's supposed to be a cultural experience for them. And while we're out, wherever we go, we expose them to other colleges, because our goal on any trip that we take in the summer, the purpose is to identify certain colleges along the way. And we try to expose them to religious institutions, private institutions, two-year institutions, four-year institutions, because the goal is to help them go to the college that fits their need the most, not to recruit for Iowa State. In fact, legally, we cannot even use the Upward Bound program to recruit for Iowa State because it's federally funded 100%. And so we have to expose our students to as many colleges along the way as we go to Yellowstone. We'll try to make a couple stops, and then on our way back, we'll take a different route so we can catch a couple more colleges.
What is the TRIO?
The TRIO programs were first started in the 60s by the Johnson administration, and originally there were three, and that's why they are called the TRIO programs. It was Upward Bound, another program that we have at Iowa State that I direct also, called Educational Talent Search, that also serves middle and high school students with the same goal as Upward Bound, except that they serve more students because their services are less intensive than the Upward Bound program. And then the third leg of the TRIO programs is what we call Student Support Services, which we also have at Iowa State University. When we are done with Talent Search and Upward Bound students and we send them off to college, most two-year colleges and four-year colleges have Student Support Services to take over what we did for our students. So they provide free tutoring for them at the college level because we don't want to set them up to fail, give them services while they are in high school only to let them lose when they get to college. So the third leg of the TRIO programs was formatted so that it will take over. It's like a pipeline, so to speak. So we're not leaving them alone. When they get to college, there's the Student Support Services program that takes over from what we have started with these students. The original TRIO were Talent Search, Upward Bound, and Student Support Services. And now we've grown out of bounds and into 8 programs. So within Iowa State, there's a 4th TRIO program. So now we're still called TRIO, but in total, there are 8 TRIO programs. Okay. Over the years, different branches have been introduced into it. The one that we have at Iowa State, in addition to the 3 that I've talked about, is called the Ronald E. McNair Program, which is named after the African-American astronaut who died in the Challenger, in that accident. And so this is the Ronald E. McNair Program. TRIO program probably is the only one that has an ethnic component to it, in addition to the income and the first generation criteria, because their goal is to seek out ethnic minority students who are currently in college and try to see if they can help them someday is to get them to get a PhD in fields that are normally you don't find ethnic minority people, specifically to get them to go into education, to be professors. That's the role of McNair. And then Upward Bound has 2 different legs on it, which we don't have at Iowa State, but veterans have their own Upward Bound program. And then there's an Upward Bound for math, science, so STEM related. That's the 6.
Thank you for coming in, because this is a really busy time of year. You're getting summer programs ready.
Yes. Thank you, Susan, for having me here. Anytime I get the chance to talk to people about the TRIO programs, I like to take the advantage to do that. It's the last best thing that is free.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. You just heard from Jane Ajeman telling us about programs that for decades have been giving students living in poverty the tools they need to succeed in college. If you heard all the interview, you know that these 2 programs, TRIO and Upward Bound, started in 1965 during the Great Society of President Lyndon Johnson's administration. In the war on poverty, there were a lot of innovative programs to lift people out of poverty. As the Vietnam War took more of the nation's money, as well as its energy, most of those programs died. As Jane was leaving, I asked her how they had kept this one alive. She answered, "Every year we go to the Hill." I asked, "You mean Washington?" She answered, "Yes, we all go to lobby, and we always get bipartisan support." I thought that was a nice ending to the story.
Thank you. grew so scared of having nothing. That what I had I couldn't see. I came upon myself the coming. I saw the wind push through the trees. So free. The kings up in their castles, who sit and make their grand decree. Well, sorry man, I owe you nothing, and you can't put your feet on me. Sorry man, I owe you nothing. You can't put your terms on me. No, I'm free. Dawning. I see the captives been released. I see him smiling, spent and fallen. Across the sand into the sea.
That was A New Day is Dawning by Paul Doffing, leading into our conversation with Pat Schlarbaum and Mark Edwards about Wild Iowa Discovery.
Okay, today on Local Talk, Mark Edwards, a fellow retiree from the Department of Natural Resources that has probably done more for conservation in the recent era than his whole 30-year career as a trail builder for the department. Welcome, Mark Edwards.
Hi, Pat.
And today we're going to talk about an upcoming gathering that is designed for May 24th.
That's correct.
And go ahead with who, what, where, when, and why. And we'll get into the why towards the end.
Okay. Well, we're calling it the Wild Iowa Discovery. And through my 30-year career at the DNR, I learned pretty quickly that Iowa is the most biologically altered state in North America, and so we're going to focus on that. And or do you want to go in?
Well, when we say that, you know, there's a lot of civilization has proceeded, but particularly here in Iowa, we had a prairie, and we had some woodlands, and we had some marshes. So you're saying those have all been altered. Is that modern agriculture?
Yeah. We've done statistical checks. And for one, we're worried about diversity. And we're saying, so we've got corn and soybeans on two-thirds, 66% of the 36 million acres in Iowa, roughly. And then we've got another roads and highways is 6%. And then you agricultural use of grazing, hay fields, that we're up to about 97, 98% has been devoted for agricultural use over since its settlement. So we have a little less than 2% public land. So now we're trying to figure out how do we bring back some of that wildness, which is what produced the soil that we're all living off of here in the agricultural state of Iowa. And it's quite frightening as we've added up the wildlife diversity, seeing that dwindle with a lot of species, and then other species are trying to come back. And so we're trying to figure out how to provide habitat and an area for these species that are trying so desperately to come back to have a place to do it. And most people are hearing about it in terms of, say, the monarch butterfly. That's a big thing right now. It's gotten federal money, and state of Iowa is a big player in that. And so, but it's not just, you know, just butterflies. It's lots of insects, birds, all kinds of things, because the habitat is not there. We've used it for other things and converted it for agricultural mainly use.
And rewilding, maybe in a sense, I've heard Iowa referred to as the beautiful land.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, that you mentioned the prairie species. That's, you know, at that time with prairie, that was some of the most biological habitat in the world. And so we've gotten rid of 99.9% of that ecosystem, that prairie system. We're down to 30,000 acres out of 36 million. That is original prairie.
So a rewilding gathering, is it a conference?
We're not calling it that. We're hoping it's more personal involvement, not necessarily organizations. There'll be a lot of organizations, I'm sure, represented there. But it's people that kind of already have an understanding of what we're talking about here and how we're going to move in a different direction, because we know we can't continue doing development. And my background with establishing water trails programs and things like that, pretty much all that's left in Iowa to look at as corridors is these water courses, these rivers and streams. And so we're having a lot of discussion now about water quality, but we're looking at the positive side and trying to figure out how to provide corridors that will connect up these last few areas that are left, whether it's state parks or county conservation areas or even farmers that have left woodlots and things like that, prairie potholes. We have to find some way to link those together to maintain biological diversity, because all of them are losing diversity. So
you mentioned conservation organizations. Well, could you name a few?
Well, we've been working closely with the Iowa Environmental Council of late, Iowa Heritage Foundation. But right now, the reason we're having this get-together is we're bringing in the Wildlands Network, which is a national, actually international organization. And they started back late 80s, early 90s. Michael Soule started the conservation biology concept. And that was the idea that you had to have maintained core areas, and they had to be of a certain size to maintain diversity. And then you had to provide buffers, and you had to provide connections between them. So that idea has taken off, and we have on the East Coast, they've come quite a ways with developing this green corridor all down the East Coast, all the way down the West Coast. But the whole middle of the United States, say in particular, has been left and not even mapped as how to do that. So our idea is to start with Iowa, which is ground zero, and figure out how to take that concept and start applying it to how we're going to go into the future. And then we're going to work through the watershed of the Mississippi, which we call the Western Rivers Corridor, which is 31 states. And none of that has been looked at in terms of how do we connect those things up so that flow of life and that can go across that landscape. And we know it does. It's still struggling to, whether it's ducks or butterflies or fish or what, you know, cougars we're talking now, things like that. We know there's a, you know, struggle for that life to still move across this landscape. And you know, we're working off the rewilding concept that our, you know, in wildness is the preservation of the world, Henry David Thoreau. And we understand that conservation biology, the science is telling us, and this is the principle of ecology, is that the healthier the system is, the more biological diversity to the system, the healthier the individual. And we're an individual in those systems. So our health and future is determined by the health of those systems.
That really covers why to put on a gathering of this dimension. And so there, name some of your other speakers.
Oh, please. Well, we did this. We did a big push in 2006-07, and we brought in speakers from out of state. Bill McGibbon, a pretty big environmentalist. We brought in Gary Snyder, philosopher on this when this first started way back in the 80s, 90s. And so we didn't like the idea of bringing someone from somewhere else to come tell us what we needed to do here, because they weren't familiar with here. So what we've done now with the Wildlands Project is we've brought them in to provide an overarching thing to give us examples of what they've done other places. But we, the group, is mostly people that I know fairly already understand the concepts. We're all, you know, a lot of them are retired DNR people, retired people from the Corps of Engineers. We understand the principles of this conservation biology. And so we're trying to figure out how do we devise an overarching umbrella for the state of Iowa to look forward, not look back, or not fight over all these individual little fights that we're going through. We have to look at what's going to be the long-range, enduring future for all of us and all the other things trying to live here.
And let's insert the time, location,
okay,
and websites.
We're having our preliminary meeting at the Thursday. It's May 24th, and that's at the Iowa Arboretum and that's just south of Boone there, a few miles. And really, like I say, haven't focused on this particular species, but we have Doug Haar with Audubon. We have Bruce Ehrsman. We have various people that are come in and talk about the plans that have been looked at and done. A lot of people put a lot of work into this over a lot of years. There's a lot of maps been done. But there hasn't been this overarching vision of how does Iowa connect up with all the surrounding states from a biological position. And we've done a wild or the bird conservation areas. Pat, you, I think, worked on all that. I mean, a lot of people have worked on these things, put a lot into them through agencies and bureaucracies that really haven't precipitated out too well. You know, in Iowa, we don't seem to honor our natural biological diversity because there's little out there to appreciate in a way. And so we have prairie enthusiasts and we have insect people. We have people that are into it from a lot of different directions. But I think we need a vision that pulls us all together to understand, you know, we're all in the same boat here. You know, you can't keep fouling your nest and expect to have some place to go. Yeah. You know, so.
And so let's go to the Iowa Arboretum. What time?
Let's see, from 1 to 4.
And it's fantastic. Yeah. What a beautiful setting, beautiful place in a beautiful land, and a very appropriate topic. So with that, we're listening to Local Talk, KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, with Mark Edwards talking about a rewilding gathering to occur at the Iowa Arboretum, May 24th, 1 to 4. Where would you like to see Iowa to go?
You know, there's two levels to that answer. One is the human, and one is, you know, I'm trying to have a home for all the species that I've grown to come and love through my job and through my interaction with those species. But I also, you know, I love the connection that it makes with the people. The people that I've met through prairie or whatever their interest in that great outdoors, paddling, I don't care what. Those are people I love being around. You know, they love where they live. They care. They're not maybe the fighters over some, you know, monies and things like that, but they're out there to enjoy what is here. And that says a lot to me.
Essentially says it all when it gets down to strengthening a community.
Yes, that's
and providing diversity.
That's right.
It can be somewhat daunting here in Iowa. You know, as you say, 98-99% altered. I mean, we can almost throw in the towel and say agricultural interests, I guess you've won. And apparently you're under the mandate that more needs to be done for conservation or wildlife areas.
Yeah. And I think this gets into why we call it rewilding and why we're using the word wildness instead of wilderness or conservation areas or things like that. We're trying to follow through with that idea of wildness. Wildness is everywhere. You can't get rid of wildness. It's in your stomach. It's what digests your food. You could go on and on. You know, you cockroaches, whatever it is. You're not going to get rid of the wildness. But like I say, your health and future is dependent on that wildness. And that's the relationship we've kind of lost. You know, we've moved into an artificial world of computers and things like that. But those are all directly dependent on that outside real world. And so we need to figure out how as a culture, how as a spiritually, economically, we're going to work with that to have a viable future. And that's exciting to me. I mean, we're in a wilderness we've never experienced as human beings before in a way, in the most biologically altered. And now we're, you know, all this new technology. No one has ever been here in human history where we are now. So what does that mean?
Well, I know the Yankton Nation is very uplifted by the return of the bald eagle and trumpeter swans and sandhill cranes. And it's becoming pretty apparent that some of these species are coming around helping us to do more.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got it. I mean, that's the encouraging part. You can't stop that wildness, you know. It's going to flow across. And I think that's why we focused on Iowa. Iowa's like the major roadblock. It's like the interstate and the frogs trying to get from one side to the other. Because, you know, for example, I go to the negative side is, you know, the lesser scob duck, the most common diving duck in North America, can't fly across the state because it can't find enough to eat in the water. That's how bad the water is. So we could go that way. But at the same time, we've got cougars coming across. We've got wolves coming in. We've got moose. We've got creatures.
Bears.
Yeah, I mean, things. And you know, we could talk about ticks and disease, too. You know, that wildness comes in lots of different ways. So whether it's Lyme disease or whatever. I mean, So we've got to figure out our place with that, you know. And you know, I look back at, as you mentioned, cultures here before, and they had that relationship of, you know, the deer family, the bear family. They understood the relationship and the importance of those other species as part of their community. And we need that discussion within our culture because we're kind of going this other way where it's all atomized. It's all me, me, me. And somehow the world doesn't work on me. It works on relationships. And we need to look into that more.
Coming up, May 24th.
May 24th, Iowa Arboretum, just south of Highway 30, there south of Boone, a little west of Ames and near Ledges State Park. Beautiful area if you got extra time in the morning and you get there early. Des Moines River Valley, Greenbelt, there's a lot of wildness in that area. My background is we had environmental ethics conferences here in Iowa back, late 80s, early 90s. And we brought in people from all over talking about environmental ethics. And at that time, it changed my life. It really did because I met a lot of people looking into these things a little deeper, not just the negative, but where do we live and where do we want to live? And so from that, then we started doing these wild discovery things in 2007-08. And those were just even more inspiring. And so more and more it's been building. But what that did for me, I want to have the opportunity to provide that to other people because it was life-changing for me. Especially with young people, I think, you know, all they're hearing is the doom and gloom and all this kind of stuff. And I think this is the future. This is what we're talking about. And this is the opportunity we have as elders, as we get older, and the people that have been doing their jobs trying to do these things over the years. We want to provide that input so that they can step forward and they direct this conversation. And we just want to help with that. And we're trying to work with Iowa State and the various colleges, universities, because those are the people that are going to be stepping into this world. And I just want to offer them what I got out of it. It was life-saving. It didn't matter about the negativity. It mattered about, you know, this is the future. This is where I want to live. This is what's exciting. You know,
so in the KHOI community, this seems to be an incredible opportunity to engage very philosophical and yet very appropriate discussion on wildness in Iowa, May 24th. Thank you, Mark Edwards.
Okay. Yeah, great. Thank you, Pat.
thanks to both of you. And the time at the Arboretum is from 1 to 4. That's tomorrow. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today. Other voices you heard were Dennis Hart, Fred Hubbell, Cal Halliburton, Jane Ajerman, Mark Edwards, and Pat Schlarbaum. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was A New Day Dawning by Paul Doffing from the CD, Songs from a Quaking Heart. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.